Good evening, this is Gary Kavner here on the right side. I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. Today is the 4th of the 11th month. You'll be pleased to know I am no longer recording from inside a fishbowl, so audio quality should be better. Here are the stories we have today. Leo has got himself into a spot of bother because he's made comments about asylum seekers and illegal immigration into the country, which have been deemed, I think, broadly horrific by those in the area. And we're seeing an investigation into Michael Healy-Ray for, I'm not sure if they're alleging misuse. I think at this stage they're being very careful to phrase it as a sort of, well, we're just questioning the timing of a day in which Michael Healy-Ray was tagged in as being in the Dáil and then was also apparently at a funeral in Kerry. And there could be some sort of expenses scandal kind of brewing there. We want to talk about that, though, and also a little bit of the behaviour we're seeing from Fine Gael recently that seems to be either ill thought out or some sort of personification of a death drive, if you want to get Freudian about it, which we of course do. Michael, to start with, Leo on asylum seekers. Well, sorry, Leo on illegal immigration more.
Yeah, it's almost as if the inner rightist in Leo is starting to leak out. He can't help himself. And why indeed should he? Anybody who has looked at the figures that are published each year to show the countries from whence the largest numbers of people applying for asylum in Ireland are will know that the number one source of Irish refugees is Georgia. And Albania is on the list. From, I think, is Syria on the...
Actually, no, sorry, Albania is number one now.
Is Albania number one?
Albania is number one.
Well done, Albania. You see, if you commit to something, you have a dream, you push through it, you can be number one.
I mean, so what Leo has said is that migrants from Albania and Georgia are coming in with fake documents, and they're behind a rise in the numbers seeking asylum in the country. And of course, the Irish Refugee Council has come out and done the standard. That is reprehensible.
Well, he makes the point, and the point is hard to quibble with, that almost 40% of the asylum seekers who land in Ireland either come from Georgia or Albania. The numbers is the numbers. I mean, you can't quibble with that. Where they, I think, are more concerned to quibble is with the notion of a safe country.
Yeah, they do make the point. Yeah, they say that picking out particular nationalities is dangerous, and to suggest that a country is de facto safe for all is very dangerous. Do you know what the rejection rate is for Albanian applicants for refugee status?
If my memory is, I think the two Albanians get, I can't remember. It was 90. The rejection rate is over 90%, I think, isn't it? Well,
so to put this in context, the rejection rate for people from Syria coming in and trying to claim refugee status is 1.75%. So the system can recognise a refugee situation. The rejection rate from Albania is 99%,
yeah,
or at least was in 2018, and that's at the very first instance. So one Albanian out of 459 was deemed to be a refugee.
And well done him. And you know, if he's listening in and wants to come on and explain why, we'd be fascinated.
That is a glorious acceptance rate of 0.03%.
And Georgia?
Georgia, 97% rejection rate.
Now, I don't know if the number is right in front of me, but I have seen the numbers many times. And if you look at the top 10, the actual figures on, you have countries, Zimbabwe, Nigeria, I'm fairly sure are on the front page of the, on there on the top 10 figures. Anyway, I think out of the top 10 countries, two out of the top 10 are actually countries that you might think were actually places which were kind of tricky, and the rest of them, kind of hard to see where the specific was. Now, the problem with the criticism that no country is completely safe, that's true of all countries. I mean, no country could be described as perfectly safe. Monaco is not perfectly safe. You could be walking along the street in Monaco and somebody from France who came in for a night's criminality could mug you. Nobody's perfectly safe. You can't. That's not. You can't run a railroad on that basis. I don't know if you noticed, the Georgian ambassador was quick to row in and, I suppose, support the Taoiseach when the ambassador George Zurashbashvili, the proper Georgian name, told the Independent that there are no political circumstances for a Georgian person to seek asylum in any other country. He continued, to my knowledge, the majority of asylum seekers are not granted asylum due to the groundless basis for their application. Because, of course, Georgia is the kind of place where everybody is pretty nice and safe and the government wouldn't do bad things to them. No, I'm sure Georgia is no Ireland, but everything has... There are we put limits on things, we put lines, and these are the lines that we have put. But whatever about the rights and the wrongs of it, Gary, why is Leo talking about it?
Well, I would imagine either because he thinks it's true and it's annoying him, or because he thinks there's votes in it, or possibly both.
Or possibly both.
I mean, it's entirely possible that after hearing the Irish refugee NGOs talk for a while, there is a little bit of an urge to go, yeah, but we also know a lot of this is nonsense, isn't it?
Mm.
I did find it interesting. If you go onto the Irish Refugees Council's website.
Yes.
And they have an FAQ about asylum. And they go, who is a refugee? And they say, well, a refugee is anyone who leaves their country because they fear persecution for one of the following reasons, which are race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, and political opinion. However, that's not actually it. That is one of the steps to being a refugee. They actually don't point out that under the relevant treaties, you also need to have a well-founded fear that the country you are in, your home country, is unable to protect you.
Yes, and that the important phrase there is well-founded. It can't be simply your perception or your feeling. It has to be well-founded, according to the lights of the investigating organisation.
So you can absolutely be suffering from persecution. But if your state, the state you are in, your country of origin, is willing to protect you or is able to protect you, and you leave the country, you're not a refugee. You're merely someone who something unpleasant happened to. And that's, I think, is Leo's point about safe countries.
No.
And probably why the rejection rate is so high.
To be fair to Leo, and I don't want to be, and to be fair, in fact, to the council, the refugee council, and again, I don't want to be, it isn't always a simple, straightforward kind of a thing, but we consider to be safe and unsafe. For example, there are, shall we say, levels, you can call it cultural evolution, cultural development, on certain kinds of social issues, which are going to be very different in different countries. Whether or not you take these things to be acceptable or unacceptable, if you talk to anybody who has been talking to people who are gay, say, in Russia these days under Putin, or I have no personal knowledge of what is the situation for gay men in Georgia, but I can speculate. Out of ignorance and probably incorrectly, but you can speculate that historically that part of the world has not been, and has not been, is not a particularly welcoming part. Now, it may be the case that there are low levels, or maybe not so low levels of violence against gay men. There may be problems regarding freedom of association. Clubs, bars, maybe. Difficult. There may be low levels of intimidation or violence, which the state is either unwilling or is at least not enthusiastic about vindicating the rights of its gay citizens in defending them against this kind of wider cultural aggression. So maybe you could say that for somebody like that, or say if you are from an ethnic minority in Albania, say you are. There are Serbs in Albania. I can't imagine there are Serbs at different times in Albania have probably been enormously popular. and maybe there would have been issues regarding that. So it isn't as obvious and as straightforward as we might like to make out. But in the generality, these are countries that are safe. But the point that the human rights organizations are making is one which, if we should, in fairness, recognize that there may be at times some substance to the observation that just because a country is safe doesn't necessarily mean it is safe for everyone. Anyway.
Albanians and Georgians, mostly a safe country.
Yes, I mean, pretty, in the context of the rest of the world, I'd say pretty safe indeed. Pretty safe and nice and comfortable and better there than in large parts of other continents.
And if you're interested in reading about this yourself, the side of things is covered by Council Directive 2004-83-EC.
Oh, that's that one, is it? Oh, right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
The relevant parts are Article 2, which is the definition, Article 8, 9, 10.
So before we move on, because I don't know that, there is one other thing that you should advert to that Leo did say. And I think it's important because it's true. And that people who are not of the left need to recognize this. Reasonable people do. Ireland was not being swamped or flooded, but neither could the government tolerate an illegal entry. He's trying a bit of a balancing act here. He's throwing a bone to people who are worried about the issue of migration and asylum seekers, but at the same time, simply say this, telling the truth. The notion, and there are unscrupulous people who I think are doing this for reasons other than plain honest politics, who are stirring up the notion that there are thousands and thousands of people flooding in through our ports and airports every week in an attempt to seek asylum here and live on our welfare system. And that's just simply not true. The numbers are consistently low in the context of the rest of Europe. But just last point, this, Gary, this is on the back of the, I imagine to some extent, on the back of the Achill Island incident, right?
Yes.
They still
have... And well, also the various other incidents.
But exactly, but my point is, with the Achill Island, it's exactly the same as all of the other incidents. They haven't learned. They keep doing the same thing, and yet...
They have slightly learned about Achill. Learned a little bit about media positioning.
How so?
You've seen the coverage of Achill where there was this sort of, sort of community comes together to stop 13 vulnerable women.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The first third, yeah.
You look back on the media 2 days before that protest. Yes. And it's no longer 13 vulnerable women. It's a larger group.
Yes.
Mostly male. Interesting. So there was a little bit of learning here.
Learning. I think you could say learning or you could say lying.
I think
you could say spinning and media manipulation. That's absolutely
correct.
It's
definitely a lie of omission, and it's definitely something the media deliberately chose to do. They may just consider it's a better story, but at the very best, it is a lie by omission.
Yeah, they moved from, and this has been going on. We know this from, the screenshots exist, shall we say. The numbers went, it was not a particularly 38, something like 38 mixed group, down suddenly. And this was the narrative, which was relentless all day on the radio, because I was in the car and I heard lots of news. It was 13 vulnerable women. And that was the phrase. That was the phrase that everybody had to use. 13 vulnerable women. So obviously, the people of Achill Island. But explain to me, Gary, how that is going, doing that, creating that particular narrative, is going to ingratiate yourself and help these vulnerable women be welcomed by the people of Achill Island by making the people of Achill Island sound like brutish, horrible, threatening, frightening, exclusive, you know, unsympathetic people. How is that going to work for you? It may win you a few points at the breakfast tables of South Dublin regarding their perception of what's going on in Achill and the people of Achill and lowering the opinion that they have of them. But how it's actually going to do practical good to help to persuade the people of Achill to stop the protest and allow this to go ahead, I am at Michael, a loss.
Michael, you say protest, but that's not how Charlie Flanagan described it.
No, how did Charlie describe it?
He said it was a siege.
A siege?
A siege, Michael. Presumably there are fishermen on Ako right now setting up trebuchets.
A siege of 13 vulnerable women, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, they'll bring the women and the locals will load them into a trebuchet and fire them into the ocean. That is apparently where we're going with this.
Well, I suppose it's off season. You get tourists in for anything. I return to my original point. They still are refusing to engage with local communities. They're refusing to go and talk to them and say, for example, one of the points about this was that this was not going to be a long-term thing because they weren't talking about the situation where they were taking over a hotel which had been built under the planning laws in the boom times and it was sitting idle. Rather, a hotel which is a busy business, a going concern, but because it's off-season, had some rooms available. But once Easter ticks around and they'll say, sorry, no, or even Christmas, I don't know, but certainly it was for a limited stay. That fact wasn't given out to the public in Ackle. They were not aware of that. The numbers of people involved, why they were there, where they were from, none of this. It's not going to maybe work every time, I don't know. But since the idea of just rolling up out of the dark and throwing these people into these places is not working, why not try a process of actually engaging people, talking to them, informing them, and giving them some sense of control over the process, introducing them to the people, humanizing their stories, and letting the natural, sympathetic, hospitable sentiments of the Irish people work. Why keep going with a failing policy?
So the department has the issue that if they engage, they expect massive local resistance. And if they don't engage, they expect massive local resistance, largely driven by the fact they haven't engaged. And so they've gone for the, sure, just try and get it done quick. And that's basically the idea here. The problem is that means that every time this happens, so for those who aren't aware, the basic process of this happening is you will find out immediately before it's happening, as in as close to the point it's happening as they can get it. What usually happens is, because these are rural communities, someone finds out earlier, and then you have a wonderful situation where people are called down to the community to defend the line while no one believes anything they say because they've clearly tried to do this by the back door.
And if this wasn't a bad thing, why would they do it by the back door, is the response of the rural community. If this is not a terrible thing, if these people are not in some sense shady, why are they trying to do it under the cover of darkness?
I mean, one thing I will say here is there's been, like, Flanagan particularly has been coming out saying that there's alt-right elements and alt-right sentiments. One, I wouldn't trust Charlie Flanagan to have any idea what the definition of alt-right or far-right or anything is, let alone know it when he sees it. But we live in a country in which the mere attempt to build apartments in a community will lead to years of legal wrangles because people don't want any change in their community. And then we seem to think that there needs to be a shadowy far-right presence for people to have a problem with a direct provision centre.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't really seem to follow. That's
if you want to understand change in Irish communities, take any little suburban part of North Dublin or South Dublin, find a football field out of 20 and say, we're going to build something small on that, and then stand back and wait for the petitions.
Oh, I mean, you'll have Aidan O'Riordan will be there. It'll just be...
No, Aidan will definitely be there.
I did like Aidan O'Riordan's, he got involved in this and he said, well, if these were, you know, Europeans or Google workers, there wouldn't have been this issue. And firstly, if they were Europeans, that have the right to move there anyway. So that's kind of a no-starter. But I did think it must be such an odd situation for Aidan O'Riordan to hear of new people coming into a community and not have to lodge a letter of complaint.
Yeah, immediately.
I mean, just imagine how that must feel to the man. Just feels wrong.
These people are coming in here and just like that. Of course, there's no building going on, so It's not horrible and threatening, like, imagine.
Also, I do enjoy the left wing here, like the particularly the anti-fa left, kind of progressive left.
Mm.
And on one hand, because now local people have started going, well, direct provision is horrible and we don't want it near us.
Yeah,
it
shouldn't exist. You have to say that both sides are learning a little bit here about the spin machine.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is this sort of, well, yes, it's horrible and it's racist and oppressive, but you should absolutely want one in that hotel.
Yeah, you should welcome it.
And then you just go, no, well, by refusing to allow this, we're putting pressure on the government to dismantle a misogynistic and oppressive... whatever.
We refuse to be complicit in this system of oppression. And by our refusal, we're going to provoke the crisis that will result in its destruction.
I can just imagine someone looking at them, wanting to give out to them. And just this kind of long, low noise in the back of the throat of a sort of...
Yeah, but you're not really. Because you're all a bunch of horrible, racist, culty bogmen. But you're just saying things.
Yeah, you should do what we would do in leafy suburbs of Dublin. We'd make this a legal issue and it wouldn't happen.
Just would.
Protesting is just...
Wither on the vine. I don't know. I understand your explanation of why they do it like this. I just, at this point, would it not be worth the risk of actually just trying a different strategy and maybe... being shocked and horrified to discover that might actually work.
Look, if there's, well, yeah, obviously there's a point to a different strategy, or, you know, maybe using some state land to build a centre. However, I think there is a political use in this, because Flanagan has come out and said he's going to push ahead with the housing on Ackle.
Yeah.
Now, whether or not that actually happens is another thing, but it enables Flanagan to sort of go... Yeah, we're on the right side here and push ahead on what is a terrible policy to begin with, actually. But this is not a government for going, was this a strategic error? Should we change this?
That is very true.
This is like a man just slamming his skull off a wall and hoping it's going to break before his skull.
Yes, that's a graphic image, but you know what? It pretty well communicates.
Like how many areas have you seen this government do something and you go, that's maybe a kind of decent idea or at least a relevant idea, and if they changed it somewhat, it would go far more easily, and they just never change it. They just keep doing it.
I have never seen an administration so committed to maintaining the line on different issues at times.
But they don't even like the line.
No, that's the thing. The line has no positive politics to it. There is no good economic outcome to it. There may be no good social outcome. There's no good polling outcome. But this is the line. This is maybe a bit glib, but there is sometimes a tendency with weak people to confuse steadfastness with strength. That you pick a line and you stick to it. Do you know who was the single most flexible politician of our lifetime and in living memory?
It was Charlie High.
Oh, much more than Charlie. Bertie Ahern. And the number of times that Bertie would, a policy would be picked up, tried, disposed of, and another policy picked up, tried, and then eventually, it might even be an opposition policy. And somebody from the press would say, but Bertie, 3 years ago you said the most horrible things about that. This couldn't work and that couldn't happen, but this must go ahead. And Bertie would look at them and would genuinely say, yeah, that was then and this is now. And then go on, as if that was it. He had explained the evolution. Everything was now hunky-dory. That was then, this is now. Bertie had, he didn't get married to things. If the thing ran out of political control, then you changed it. I mean, the obvious example is the hospital.
It also did help that Bertie was very, very capable of going... There's just sort of a Bertie-shaped void.
Yes.
And the edges kind of blurred. And then you're like, was that always his policy?
Yeah.
He's talking as if it was always his policy, but it sounds very, very, very like the opposition policy. And the opposition seem to think it's very like their policy, but even they seem confused about whether or not it is in fact their policy.
Yeah, Bertie...
And by the time they realised it was generally over the line.
At one stage, Bertie was the helmsman at probably the most right-wing economically government, right-wing economically driven government of this that we've had in the state. And then within half a dozen years, he was standing up in the Dáil declaring himself a socialist. And the thing is, it was all true. At any one time, this was what Bertie was. But that, without turning this in simply into an agonium for Bertie, my point is that Bertie's strength is not in the ability to maintain a position no matter how much the circumstances have changed. The obvious example of we're talking of is the hospital. And the hospital seems to me to manifest all of the bizarre psychopathology of the state, that again and again and again it became obvious that so many people were opposed to it, and opposed to it for so many different reasons. But the line was, and this was a line which was used about the hospital, but not just the hospital, it was used about the broadband plan and other things. A decision has been made. The important thing is a decision had to be made and we made it. And this, you can sense this pride in this fact, sir, that we should recognise that they've done this thing, they've made a decision, and they should get credit for that. The fact that the decision was absolutely bog-awful is not relevant to the discussion right now. They made a decision, they're good boys, and they are not going to be going changing their minds. It's part of the psychopathology of these people. And it's not likely to change race anytime soon. And certainly Charlie has it. But Leo is slightly off-pieced comment made by Leo regarding immigration is not the only thing Leo has been saying lately. It's like the rightist is leaking out in him. He can't control it. So you never know, Leo. He may provide us with some entertainment, yes.
Do you think Leo is just, after years of this, there's just the rising urge for like one good right-wing policy?
Well, if you remember...
Just get it out the system and then you can go back to this sort of anemic Jesus is love.
Back in the day when...
Version of government.
When Leo had arrived just about and he was Minister of Transport and Fun. And there was a group of them. There would be Leo. He was great pals with Lucinda Crichton, Paul Bradford, Jean-Paul Phelan, Pascal Donohue. I mean, these were people who had, I don't know if they read them, but they possessed books written by Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman et al. They were regarded as the most right-wing group of TDs to come into the Fine Gael party since Owen Duffy. And they have singularly failed to live up in any way, shape or form, either socially or economically or politically to that tag. Maybe there is some deep hankering within Leo, some deep blue. Maybe he'll reintroduce hanging. Although we'd have to have a referendum for that, wouldn't we?
I think we should bring back hanging. These tumble dryers are useless.
Very good.
Anyway, before we go, John Paul Phelan has called for an inquiry into Michael Healy Ray, of all people.
Of all people, yes.
Of all people. I know, so we said at the start that there was some questions about Michael Healy Ray fobbing into the Dáil and then going down to a funeral in Kerry. And the reason you do that is so that you can claim expenses for the day and that you're marked in as being present, because I believe you need to be present some amount of days.
120 days.
In order to get a... I'm not really actually interested in what Michael Healy Ray did or didn't do, or the appropriateness of what Michael Healy Ray did or didn't do. I will say I trust Michael Healy Ray that if he did something which is in some way questionable, he did it in a way that's unlikely to backfire spectacularly upon himself, which would be to say, I think if Michael Healy Ray did something, it's likely that a great deal of other people are also doing it.
I am...
Which makes me kind of go, is this really something you want to have an inquiry into?
This is one of those things where you see the headline and your first reaction is, now, John Paul, why are you doing this? What's going on here? Because it is very, very hard to imagine. We're talking, it's not button gate, it's now fob gate. It is a gate already. That if this practice exists widely, then it will exist, it will have existed or exist also amongst the blue shirts. Now, John Paul may be in his heart happy and content that he himself is Simon Pure and has never done such a terrible thing as to be artificially fobbed in. However that might happen, I don't know the mechanics of how you would fob in but not be there, bar having the quality of ubiquity. But he knows that there are going to be some of his party colleagues. Surely there's... Okay, I'll put it this way. It would be fair to say, Gary, surely, that there is no way that he can know for certain that none of his party colleagues will not be caught up in the net if they start to go trawling for this. There's no way he can be confident that everybody in the back benches of Fine Gael is safe and sound, or indeed the front benches. Why would you start this unless you were just out for a Skype?
Michael, I'll occasionally look at Dáil TV, and I will occasionally see someone, and they could be from any party, and you just look at them, and internally you're going, who the fuck is that?
Yeah, well...
But presumably that person is fobbed in enough to get their expenses.
Mm, yes.
But yet you never really see them. And they do seem to come from pretty much all parties, at least the larger parties, which would suggest to me this will kind of go poorly for all involved. Also, if you're going to really take a shot at anyone, you may want to take a shot at someone less capable than Michael Healy-Ray, who, despite what anyone thinks of him or his public persona, is an immensely sharp man.
Oh,
and is more than capable of, if Fine Gael cause a problem for him, causing some real big problems for Fine Gael.
Michael Healy-Ray, he falls very much into the category of those knives that you don't keep in a drawer, you keep on your magnet on the wall because if you were to put your fingers on that blade, you would get them badly cut. He is one of the sharper tools in there. And as you say, Gary, I'm sure that if he were to be pursued and to be pursued to effect, that he would be capable of some kind of retribution, of which would the kind of retribution that would have people turning around to John Paul Phelan in a few months' time saying, why the fuck did you do that, Phelan?
It's just a wide-ranging inquiry into Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil politicians and people walking by John Paul Phelan and going, well, is this what you wanted?
Are you happy?
Did you not think this would happen?
Then again, for all we know, maybe John Paul is sitting up there a little bit bored, and that's precisely what he wants. You know, just for his own entertainment.
Like, I don't know if you've been looking at Fine Gael's recent attack ads on Fianna Fáil.
Yeah, I don't get them. I just don't. It's more like something that you would have expected in the house race for Connecticut.
So, they are very American. I would imagine they brought in an American consultancy firm and build nation builder databases and that sort of thing, and they're all doing it. But there's been two real ones. There's been one saying that you can't trust Fianna Fáil with the economy because of what happened in the crash, which you look at and you immediately go, okay, well, there's someone in Fianna Fáil's office gone to dig out the election manifestos of Fine Gael from around 2000.
Which I have myself, and I enjoy...
I also quoting, still have a copy of.
I enjoy quoting them at my blue shirt friends when they talk about their responsibility. Responsibility? Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. No, look at spending plan number 5.
Yes, there is a little bit of we would have stopped the crash. Like, no, looking at this, it would have just been harder and faster.
Their version of stopping the crash would have been to get the petrol, to light the petrol quicker and throw the cans in on top and just get it exploding.
But even ignoring that, we have the National Broadband Plan. We have the Children's Hospital. We have a nearly endless array of financial scandals and general bollocksing of public funds.
And Swingate.
And all of that immediately came up. And that was the public response to go, yeah, maybe, but you lads. And then they released a new ad there which said that Fine Gael have no policies. Only 5 of their spokespeople have put out policies. And I saw that and I went, okay, what's going to happen? Here's two things. Firstly, every Fine Gael spokesperson is going to get a list of every piece of legislation they have put forward, and every piece of that legislation the government has shut down. And they're going to go on the offensive. And then it's going to look like Fine Gael, or Fine Gael, doesn't care about actual legislation, just policy papers. And the second thing is that Fine Gael are going to go through every Fine Gael spokesperson's background.
Yeah.
Here's how often you've spoken the Dáil. It's below average. Here's how many pieces of legislation you put forward. It's below average, which they've already started to do. Turns out Kildare Street gives that a figure.
Tell me, I mean, who is it cares about policy papers? They make this sound like these people never produced a policy paper. I want to meet the average Irish voter out there. Who cares?
I get the intent. The intent is to attack Fianna Fáil and to say that they've no plans. They're just going to do something randomly. They're just winging it.
I understand the intent. I'm just saying that shooting, you know, this is very much a case of, you know, this is what the little boy shot at. Nearly never shot a crow. It might be the intent to do that, but I think as a piece of political advertising to affect an Irish voter, I think it's rather poor and rather unlikely to move the hearts and minds of the Irish voter, who would say, my God, look at that, he never produced a paper on the use of gender-neutral toilets in Castletroy secondary schools. Why hasn't he done this? Why haven't we had more policy papers from this man? When the reality is most of them want to know why hasn't he got the N75 depotholed?
Also, I mean, if there's one thing you can not say about Micheál Mark, it's that he's never published a policy paper.
No, Micheál.
I mean, if you average it out and you include Micheál Martin, you're probably still looking at a very good level of policy paper production amongst the Fine Gael Frenchmen.
Micheál likes a good policy paper, he does. He likes to stretch out of an evening and say, let's hammer out another policy paper, lads.
He likes a good policy paper. He likes a bad policy paper.
Yeah.
He just likes a policy paper.
He does. Anyway.
But it's just, there's this weird sort of self-destructiveness about a lot of what Fine Gael is doing, where it doesn't seem like anyone is going, whatever about how effective is this is, doesn't this also reflect poorly on you?
Well, I would regard this actually as symptomatic of a fundamental flaw in the way that Fine Gael have been doing politics, well, maybe forever, I don't know, but certainly I date it since the time of when Michael Noonan was finance spokesman in the early 2000s. And that is, they think of the first page, they think of a story, or they think of a policy which is going to get them good news on the front page the next day. But they never really seem to sit down and think, okay, what happens on day two, day three, or day four? Not the story will not last, but rather there is a risk. Is there a risk, they should ask, that by day three, the story has turned against us, and that we are rather regretting ever taking it out of the box. Now, to me, I date it to the great Noonan plan, which you wouldn't remember, was Mary O'Rourke had brought the telephone company, the National Telephone Company, Aircom, to a public offering. And she had to set the price of the shares, and she set it to maximise the return to the state, which was a perfectly reasonable thing to do. Anyway, the country was swept up with all sorts of excitement about buying shares, and people were told, don't borrow money, don't do this, don't do that. But of course, people did. And they got credit union loans and whatever to buy shares in Aircom or Telecom. And then some people lost money.
Now, to be fair, Michael, if you bought shares in a company that had been a semi-state,
yes,
and was moving onto the market, and thought this was going to go well, that's really your own fault. I mean, it was obvious that what was going to happen is that company was going to, the tyre was going to hit the road and was just going to explode.
To be fair, it had been the historic experience in different countries with different administrations that the governments tended to pitch the initial price for the IPO at a little bit below what they really thought the market value was, so that ordinary people could get in. And this was Thatcher's idea of the share, you know, of a share owning democracy. Everybody would own shares, you know, property. Anyway, the point was that people lost money. Noonan came out with a great idea that those people who had lost money on the IPO for the telecom should be compensated because, you know, people are terribly upset they lost money. And it got a headline. But the problem, of course, it was perfectly, and the perfectly obvious question was, the next day, all those people who had not lost money on Aircom, which was the very large majority of people in the state, going, oh, no, hold on, I'm going to pay him. I tax, no. Oh, no, I'm sorry now. No fucking way. And it got laughed out of court. But ever since then, it seems to me that they have this tendency. And this is one of those things. Now, as I say, there may be another story here. John Paul is a bit of a divil, is John Paul. And he may be just having fun with his, he may be bored being a junior minister.
And it may also be that he just legitimately thinks that if anything is happening, it shouldn't be happening. And if it hurts Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil and everyone gets drawn into an endless cycle of recrimination and bloodshed, well, that's just the price of cleaning house.
Absolutely. That's the price I can't remember the first half, is the price of eternal vigilance. Or eternal vigilance is the price of something. And maybe this is John Paul being eternally vigilant to minding the democracy for the Irish people. And if so, well done. And kudos to John Paul. But yeah, mostly it feels like Fine Gael thinking up a good idea and then thinking, oh shit. Like the little boy pissing in the wind, he hadn't realised how quickly it would come back to him. Anyway, what day is today? Well, today is
Monday,
and it is a quite pleasant, bright kind of a day, and hopefully we won't get too much more rain, but we shall return.
We shall indeed, on Wednesday.
On Wednesday, with more nuggets plucked from the heart of the Irish political and social life. But until then,
I think dross was exactly the right phrasing.
Until then, I shall say goodbye.
All the best.